Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to ride and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
In this episode, you'll meet Lindy Birch from Weatherford, Texas. Lindy is a professional cutting horse trainer and cowgirl superstar who has won over $4 million in the cutting arena. And she is passionate about our Western heritage and way of life. She is in the NCHA Hall of Fame and the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame, just to name a few of her many accomplishments. You'll hear her story about when she was a young girl, she used homing pigeons to tell her mom that she was safe when she was out riding her horse by herself. And she speaks about the development of the famed Oxbow Ranch breeding program. Plus, Lindy shares what she does to get back up when discouraged. And if you're just starting to ride and show cutting horses, she's got some awesome advice for you. Buckle up. You'll love hearing Lindy's cowgirl state of mind for yourself.
Hey, Chickie.
The chicks.
That's right.
Two of us are here.
Exactly. Kathy would be the other one.
The third chick.
Yeah, the third chick. And we used to call each other that because we were with the guys. And we'll just
what did we call them?
We'll just leave it at that. We won't.
It rhymed with chicks, didn't it?
We won't say anything more about that. Oh, my gosh. So I got to see you this summer. You were in Montana at the Art of the Cowgirl.
I was. I decided to load my trailer up and head north for the instead of staying in the Texas summer. So it wasn't that big of a decision. And I got to show in Montana a little bit and kayak on the lakes up there and shoot skeet and also get to be part of the Art of the Cowgirl in Bozeman, which was a real treat.
Yeah, that is a real treat.
Yeah.
So did you? Where else did you go? Didn't you kind of travel all around in the summer?
Well, we did. We left. The first stop was Las Vegas, and I showed there. And then we went north and ended up staying in St. Anthony with Russ and Jill Miller for a few days.
Oh, that was fun, I bet.
It was a lot of fun. Uh-huh. And Russ is a great friend and a great trainer, and I've known him and Jill for a long time. So it was nice to kind of rekindle that friendship. As you know, at the shows, a lot of time it's pretty hectic, pretty, you know, a lot of tension, and, you know, you're there for a reason. So it's nice to get to go stay at people's places.
And hang out.
And hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and go, you know, cook hamburgers and hot dogs and, you know, play lawn games with the kids and just, you know, have fun. And I always take my dogs, so I'm always working my hunting dogs, and I'm working on them, and they're swimming and, you know, play with them. So it was fun in Idaho, which I'd never really spent much time other than with, you know, the Lufkins in Sun Valley. So got to see a different part of Idaho. And then we showed over there at what the name of that little town is just east of Bozeman. There was a nice cutting horse show. So I got to Livingston, I think it was. So I got to work there for like 3 or 4 days and show my four-year-old. And then come back to Art of the Cowgirl. And then we went to Paws Up for about 10 days. And I saw Nadine last night at the Hall of Fame function. And she said, yeah, we almost had to evict her because I wanted to stay. I just loved it. Because
They had to evict you.
They had to evict me because I just, you know, she has a beautiful barn. So my horses were well cared for. And I got to ride in the morning and, you know, give some private clinics for Nadine and her help and her granddaughter. And then we'd fly fish in the afternoon. So I got to, you know, rekindle my love of fly fishing on those beautiful rivers, you know. And then they have a skeet and a sporting clay range. So then I'd hustle over there and shoot my shotgun. So I was, and then go poor into
Lindy,
the
you
restaurant.
Had a rough summer.
And then eat and eat and drink good wine. So I just, you know, no wonder they had to evict me, because I would have stayed. I'd probably still be there. And then we had another treat. So we started south, and we went to Wyoming, mm-hmm. and got to see the most beautiful ranch, all 350,000 acres at Wagon Hound.
Oh, wow.
And I'd never been on that ranch, just heard of it. And so we put up, you know, that's a great thing with the living quarters. You can just kind of pull in and plug in or turn mm-hmm. the generator on, and you have your house. And we stayed there for about a week, worked cattle, and then Dustin was just wonderful, their manager, and gave us a great tour. And we saw a couple rattlesnakes on the ground. We ride every, because I love to ride outside of the arena. So I covered as many of those acres as I could on my horse, on my three-year-old, and had to relocate a few rattlesnakes on the way.
Oh, God.
But other than that, it was a beautiful trip and beautiful ranch. And then we continued on down to Hesperius, Colorado, showed there for 3 days, and had a good time. And then again, we find the rivers and kayak down the rivers. I love water. And then we came home. So so I could help the kids at the youth show in July. But I didn't show in the Summer Spectacular this year. I just mm-hmm. helped the kids and did the voiceover for the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got a little of the summer Texas heat.
I got rid of it. You know, I got through a bunch of it, except it's some days it was warmer in Montana than it was in Weatherford, because we had such an odd summer this year. Mm-hmm. So they saved the heat until I returned, and then it got hot in August and September. I guess state just didn't want me to miss it. But what's happened is now I've decided that next year I'm going to, you know, stay on the road quite a bit and haul. And I've got my good mare that's 4 will be 5. And I think she's ready for the open. And I have a good futurity colt. So I'll have a good 4-year-old. And I'm just going to try to stay on the road and see how far I can get.
I think I need to be your assistant.
You could. Yeah. we'd be dangerous together.
We would be dangerous. We'd be looking for the good cattle, good food, and the good wine.
Yeah, what beats that?
I know.
What more do you need?
Yeah, maybe a few rivers.
Yeah, a few rivers.
Yeah.
A few birds to shoot at so the dogs are happy.
Uh-huh.
They get to retrieve.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a good life, so that's what I'm going to try to do.
Awesome. Well, Lindy, I've never really heard the full story, so take us back to when you first started riding and, you know, how you got into horses. And
oh gosh, I've told that so many times. It's a good story, because, you know, like everybody says, there's never a dull moment, but with me, but
well, when that's current also.
it's just some things never change. My dad, I grew up in Southern California. I was born in Illinois, which most people don't know, but I was born
which
in
part
LaSalle, Peru.
Which,
Illinois.
Is that northern?
So, below Elgin. Below Chicago.
Okay.
But we weren't there for, all I remember, snowmen, and that's about it. I think I was 5 years old. We moved to Southern California. So I grew up there, and my dad always rode horses and had horses, and I always rode with him. I don't remember not riding. You know, I was very young, and I'd ride in front of him, and then I graduated to my own horse at about 5. Mm-hmm. And had a paint. Mm-hmm. So I got to always be the Indian in the kids' games, because I had the paint, so everybody else had to chase me, and I think that's why I ride so fast sometimes. Those old days are instilled in me about, you know, outrunning everybody. But so we rode just for fun. Mm-hmm. You know, like most kids have bikes, we'd ride our horses after school and all during the summer. And, my mother was not very horsey, really, but she, you know, she supported us. My dad was real horsey. So during the summer, I'd want to leave and go ride. That's what I did. and I'm 10 to 14 years old probably at this time. And we moved and lived up in Van Nuys, you know, south of L.A. And there's this huge dam called the Sepulveda Dam that would take all the runoff water and, you know, run it to the coast finally. But anyway, it was great riding. And in those days, it was all dirt. It wasn't cement like it is now. So I'd leave and I wouldn't want to come back until it got dark. I'd ride 10, 12 hours a day. But that wasn't going to work for my mother. And there were no cell phones. And there were no pay phones where I was riding. It was just complete, you know, country. If you can believe that, it isn't now, of course, all cement. So I had to invent a way where I could keep in touch with her. Or I'd have to come home, check in, and then leave again, which just wasn't going to work for me. So I saw somewhere on TV about homing pigeons. So I invested. My dad helped me build a cage, and we bought, I don't know, 20 or 30 homing pigeons. So I was raising pigeons. And my dad built a cage outside my mom's kitchen window where the pigeons would return and come into the cage, but they couldn't get out. You know, it was a one-way, like a doggy door. And I would take four or five pigeons in my saddlebags and write a little note. This is Lindy, you know. I'm at so-and-so. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. And I'd have to airmail that pigeon back.
Oh, my gosh.
To my mom. And so my mom, who, again, wasn't a big fan of birds either, would put an asbestos cooking glove on, you know, one of those long sleeve ones, reach in there, hold my pigeon down, you know, catch it, hold it down, and pull the note off his leg and read the note, and I'd be safe. I could keep riding. So I had to do that 2, 3, 4 times a day. Like every 2 hours, I'd check in. So I'd use pigeons, and when I ran out of pigeons, I'd have to head home, or here she'd come in the station wagon, honking and driving all around like a crazy woman looking for somebody on a horse, because I usually was by myself. So, and I was, of course, forbidden to go in the river. And there was a river in the middle of this big dam, in this drainage system. You know, sometimes it's 3 feet deep, sometimes it's a little deeper. Well, I'd always, of course, want to cross the river. And one time I got my horse stuck in the river, probably because all the junk people threw down there. And he got caught and fell over. And but we managed to get out of that part. But the pigeons weren't so lucky. They were drowned in the saddlebags, kind of squished. So that was early day. I had to go home quickly before my mother realized what had happened, dried off on the way. So as far as I know, they never knew that I had a near-death experience in the river.
What about the pigeons? What'd you tell them about the pigeons?
They didn't know how many I had, so... I relocated those pigeons too, so they couldn't find the dead ones, and got some new ones the next time I went out. That's why I had to have that cage with about 35 pigeons in it. But that's how I started my riding career. And then moving quickly, my dad and I, my mother, and I have a sister and brother. They're both younger. So Sundays was Mom's day, so we had to load up in that station wagon. And we would drive around Southern California and find a place to have lunch. And it was Mom's Day. It was just a day that we all spent as a family. And horses weren't, you know, involved.
Invited.
No. I don't even think the dogs got to come. So one day we were going through, I think it was Ventura or Ojai or somewhere up there. And we saw a bunch of horse trailers. So my dad pulls in and says... I said, well, what's going on here? You know, and he says, well, this is a cutting horse show. So we sat on the fence and watched him cut. This is probably, it would have been 62 or 3, 4 maybe. And I said, well, that's what I want to do. He says, well, if you work hard enough and stick with it, you know, you want it bad enough, I'm sure you can do it. I know you can do it. So then the very next week, we lived across the street from a saddle shop. We lived in Chino. And we had 5-6 acres and had our pleasure horses, trail horses out there. And I was raising baby calves because we had a lot of dairies around there. So I would go pick up the, with my dad driving, the bummer calves that those cows would have. And then I'd raise them and sell them back to the dairy or sell them wherever. So that was my little business. And a truck put, and there was an arena and a barn, just an outdoor arena, like a rope arena and a barn across the street. Travis Pierce owned this shop. Excuse me. And he, inside in the parking lot one day, right on the road, there was this blue Dodge, baby blue pickup that said Bruce Cahill, Lynn Haven, Kansas, cutting horse trainer. So I run across the street, and I wasn't driving then, so I think I was like 13 or 14. And I said, so you're a cutting horse trainer? He said, yes, I am. And I said, well, I want to learn to cut. And he, I said, that's what I want to do. He says, well, can you cut? And I said, well, not yet, but I've seen it, and that's what I want to do. He says, well, I'll tell you what. He said, I've got 20 horses here. If you'll you'll come in the morning and saddle them up, clean the stalls, saddle them up, I'll teach you how to lope, and then I'll teach you how to cut. And I said, well, what do I have to pay to do that? What do I have to pay you? He says, well, you don't have to pay me, but I'm not going to pay you either. And I go, well, that's all right. That sounds good to me. So that's what I did all summer. Luckily, it was summer. And then he started letting me turn back. And we couldn't afford a cutting horse. So what I was doing was to make more money, I would lope horses at the Pomona racetrack. Mm-hmm. They had a little training track there. So I'd lope on, you know, Saturdays and, you know, some days in the afternoons. And I worked for somebody there. I don't even remember his name, but he didn't want to pay me. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a really good horse instead. And, of course, I'm still a sucker for a horse. And I go, okay, well, what? All right, that sounds good to me. And he said, she can't race anymore. She broke down, but she's really well-bred. She ran AAA. So, of course, that means nothing to me. And I said, okay. And he said, she's kind of she's a quarter horse. And these were quarter horse race horses. I go, okay. So he traded me this mare. He owed me probably, I don't know, $600 or something. And he gave me this mare named New Oble, which was a really great-looking mare. She was by an old sire called Nudo. Anyway, I bring her home, and Bruce Cahill says, hey, this is a nice horse. And I said, well, do you think we can train her to cut? He says, hell no, we can't train her to cut. He said, but my friend Jerry Vauder in Escondido knows good racehorses, and maybe he's interested in this horse. I said, well, I want to keep her. He says, don't you want a cutting horse? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, let me see what we can do. So anyway, they got together, and they traded me this old 19-year-old horse, which was my first cutting horse, called Mr. Nifty 121, who I later find out is really kind of an ex-steer stopper more than he was a cutter. But he was cutting bred, and he was kind of a little cow horse. And back then, I don't think they were quite as specified or specific as they are now. So I think he did a lot of things. But I was thrilled with him. He was a little bay gelding and he would stop on his front end. And, oh, I still remember him jarring me. And, of course, I didn't have a saddle. So Bruce loaned me his RCA saddle, they called it an association saddle, a bucking saddle, but it had no horn. So that's how I had to learn to cut. I mean, I really wanted to do this. And luckily, I didn't know any better. I probably would have preferred something else, but I didn't know any better. I was just happy for the opportunity. So, you know, I worked my tail off. But to me, at that point, and to this point today, it still isn't work when you're doing something around a horse. It's mm-hmm. That's my pleasure. Uh-huh. That's my joy. So I started doing really well on Mr. Nifty in the 250 novice, and they had a ladies class, and there was a $100 novice back then. It was just the California Cutting Horse Association and the San Diego Association. But again, we're still in the 60s. But all of a sudden, I was doing really well, and I just work him kind of like Bruce said, and sometimes he'd tell me to do something, sometimes he wouldn't. Anyway, we just kind of learned.
Could you put your hand down?
Oh, yeah. Trial and error. But it, not at first, but after a while we could. And we started winning. And so people said, well, you want to ride my horse? And I said, sure, I'll ride your horse. So I'd jump on it and work it. And we had a practice once a week. Rex Ellsworth had a thoroughbred farm there in Chino. And he's a fellow that raised and owned Candy Spots when he won the Derby. So he had these beautiful big pastures, and he had a bunch of cattle on these pastures. So Thursday nights, he would hold, or whoever the manager was at that time, would hold a practice, cutting horse practice. 7 o'clock, Thursday night, $5, work as many cows as you want. My kind of place. But it doesn't exist anymore, Barb.
Man, I was getting ready to load up.
I'd be still be there if you could do that. But so I would go there every Thursday night with Nifty and work him. And that's when people said started saying, well, you know, work my horse and work my horse. And I'd jump on anything. And I got bucked off. I got run into the fence. I've got reared over backwards on and hit in the head. But it was all good for me. So at some point, and now I'm like 16. Now I've got a little two-horse single-axle Pruitt trailer and a pickup my dad had got me, my dad and mom. So I could come and go. And pretty soon a couple of people said, well, why don't you take this horse home and work it and then bring it back and then we'll go show it and I'll show it, you know, not me, but the person. And I said, oh, okay. They go, you do have an arena? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, I have nothing, you know. So I'm in high school and I enlist all the kids in my FFA chapter, and we all have show steers and show heifers. And I said, look, I need an arena, and I need all the cows, and I'll work the cows, and you won't have to exercise them. And everybody thought that was a great deal. So,
oh my goodness, so my dad funny.
Got us. I know, that's why I say it's never a dull moment. My dad, somehow we wrangled enough lumber. We built a little square pen, and I bet, of course, it's long gone now, but I bet it wasn't 50 foot by 60 foot. I mean, we're talking, we built it as big as we could with the lumber we had, but we didn't have a whole lot of lumber. And we had to dig, you know, post holes for railroad ties. So, you know, I had the boys over there and the girls, and we all worked. So we built this pen.
They must have really wanted their steers exercise.
Yeah, I don't know. I was a good salesman then, yeah. But there was one caveat. We had to build a chute so the boys could practice riding the cattle. Because they were all, you know, wanted to be, you know, RCA cowboys. So, but I talked them into doing it after I worked the cattle. Then we'd run them through this little plywood-built chute, put a bull rope on them, and then those that wanted to ride them got to ride them. So I've come from, my history is I used to work a lot of sour cattle. And we had a chicken ranch next to us. So anytime we make noise, the chickens would scream and holler and kill themselves in those little bitty cages, you know. So you couldn't honk your horn out there or do anything, really. And it was quite a circus, but that's how I got started. And people then kept asking, well, you know, do you have room for my horse? Do you have room for my horse?
Do you have any fresh cattle?
That was, I hope, if they asked me that, I'm sure I didn't answer truthfully because I didn't even know what a fresh cow was then. I just wanted cows. And the Joe Lugo was our FFA leader, or whatever you call him, teacher. And he says, and by the way, we all won in the fairs that we took these cattle to. They were really fit because we brought them around, and they'd have to turn back and, you know, kind of encourage them to move with a stick or so. And so we're all at the Grand National was the big, you know, there was a Pomona Fair and then the Grand National in L.A. And we're all at the winner's party, and all our cattle had won, and, you know, and Joe says, you know, I just want to, I just want to tell my chapter how proud I am of them and of the work they put in, obvious work they put into these animals, because they're in fit. We've never seen a class of steers or heifers that were any more fit, and they look great, and they're so broke. And but he was staring at me the whole time, and I'm like, you know, wiggling, trying to get behind somebody. And he says, so I just want to say that we hope the cutting horses did as well, or something like that. He knew all the time, but he let us get away with it.
So
It was great.
Yeah. Well, they were fit, right?
They were very fit.
They looked good.
The kids just didn't have to drag them around and chase them up and down the bridle paths, you know.
Well, so then what happened? How'd you move out of there? Didn't you go to... You have a degree.
I have a couple of degrees. So I always wanted to be a vet. So I went to... started out at a junior college there in Mount San Antonio, and then transferred to UCLA and you know, received a bachelor's there. But I wanted to go to Davis to get into vet school. So University of California, Davis, up near Sacramento. So I moved up there, by this time I had a couple of better horses. I don't want to say better because Nifty was great, but I had some younger horses that I was doing well on. And George Wheeler, who met my dad trail riding, said, I have a cutting horse named Hollywood Rita, and I'm looking for a cutting horse trainer because I don't like the trainer that has her now. Do you know anybody that rides cutting horses? And my dad says, well, my daughter does. And George said, well, is she any good? And my dad says, well, I don't know, but I know she'll give you 100%. So he said, okay. He said, let's try her. So he sent me this great buckskin mare named Hollywood Rita that I started doing really, really well on. And so I took her to Davis with me, stayed at Dick Winger's, who was an old cutter up there, the horses did. And I got to show and go to school at the same time. And I didn't get into vet school the first time I applied. So I just went ahead and got a master's in endocrinology. And, but, you know, they wanted me to either teach or stay in a lab and do research. Neither one was something I was interested in at that point. I just wanted to ride. And simultaneously, more and more people wanted me to ride their horses. So I just said, you know what, maybe I'll just take a couple years off and see where this goes. And people were paying me, and I don't even think I had a fee. I think I just, whatever they wanted to pay me was fine with me, you know, because it was just such a joy and pleasure, and I wanted to ride so bad because I wanted to compete. And so that's how I got started.
Wow. Well, I think the first time that I met you was in the Oxbow days in Oregon, and Bobby Nelson and all of that. So,
well, I rode, you know, I started competing in California, you know, like through high school and in my early 20s, you know, when school would permit, and just, you know, started kind of a training barn without really even trying to start a training barn at that time, and was doing really well with some horses when I met Bobby Nelson. And he, I loved, you know, Doc and Missy, and I would see him at the shows, and I would try to help, you know, because he hadn't really cut a lot. He had done more of the reining snaffle bit work. And, but he had such a fabulous mare, you know, that it wasn't hard to transfer to a full-fledged cutter, even though she won the snaffle bit. She was so cowy and such a great horse. So that started my affiliation with Bobby and Dan Lufkin, who owned the Oxbow that Bobby worked for. So then they had me up to do a couple clinics and started sending me horses. And then, you know, it just kind of took off from there.
I see. Well, and through time evolved a great breeding program.
Yes. Well,
I'd love for you to talk about that.
Dan Lufkin is such a, he's the most intelligent person I've ever met by far, but he's just so far. He just raised everybody's bar, you know, when he was around, but he was so far ahead of his time. And I remember Bobby and I and Dan were sitting at a international pancake house in Arizona, and we were there for the Sun Circuit, which was at the time a really, really one of the biggest shows there was. Mm-hmm. And it was before the Tropicana, and then they had that great show in Las Vegas after it. But Sun Circuit was a great show because the weather was great. Everybody from Texas would come out because there was nothing conflicting at that time in Texas.
And most, all the fresh cattle and
all the fresh cattle you can cut, every class. And then it evolved to two arenas back to back. So they had, and they'd go 24 hours, you know, both arenas. And they'd be loping the open horses for the next day when the, you know, the last of the classes were finishing up from the night before. Mm-hmm. It was just huge classes and good. But anyway, Dan, we're sitting there having breakfast one morning, and Dan said, Lynn, he said, you know, and I had a really good mare at the time I was showing for him at Miss I think it was pre-Miss Safari. I'm not sure what mare it was, but I was showing another mare that he didn't own, that I owned, but was a good horse. And he says, can you name me the 10... I'm interested. I want to know the 10 best brood mares you can think of that you know in this industry. The 10 best. So, and he pushed a napkin across the table and gave me his pen. So I wrote down the 10 mares that I thought were the best horses. And he bought 9 of them.
Wow.
Within the couple of months. He bought 9 of them. The other one wasn't for sale, I guess. And that's how the Oxbow brood mare started.
Wow. So what year was that?
Oh, gosh. I bet that was 74, 75.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Uh-huh.
But he, you know, that's, he bought Miss Safari, and he had Duck and Missy. He already had Duck and Missy, but then he ended up with Barely Duck. And so he bought Miss Safari, and he bought, he ended up with Doc Scaviota, Doc Barmare. You know, I should have studied a little bit before I came to do this. I could have named all 10 of them. But I, you know, there was a couple of Playboys in there, and you know, just the best mares I could think of. And then he, you know, he bred them to the best stallions. And he told me, he gave me a book years ago by, I think his name is Frederico, the last name is Tessio, and it's Tessio's system of breeding or theory of breeding, and basically you can hardly read it, it's so old and a little bitty hard brown book, but it said, what I got out of it, out of this little book was, breed the best to the best and hope for the best. And that was his, mm-hmm. you know, his theory. And it certainly worked because he, you know, the Oxbow had, at one time, I think we got up to about 43 of the greatest broodmares there were, you know, mm-hmm. in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. And, absolutely.
And they just kept churning out there, just, you know, great mare power. And I think, thanks to Dan, and he... he has this great quote by Alfred Barr, who was the curator of the New York Museum, and it's still hanging on my wall in my office. But it talks about mediocrity and excellence, and how basically, you know, it costs the same to own either animal or piece of art, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's just an, you know, if it's excellent or if it's a medium kind of a really nice mm-hmm. picture or a mm-hmm. nice horse costs the same. It costs the same to feed, costs the same to train, basically,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, it really boils down to quality, not quantity. And that mm-hmm. was, you know, something mm-hmm. that I learned so much from him early on that I know it had a lot to do with, it still does have a lot to do with my career and my success
mm-hmm.
was through Dan.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. You always have been and still are mounted on wonderful horses.
Well, I it never hurts to this day, and now it's kind of funny because, you know, you have the younger generations try to tell me how important, you know, breeding is and the maternal side, and, you know, and I just kind of look at them like, you know, you really should read more about history than, you know, it didn't start with you, you know, in other words. But I think that's youth, and in any discipline, it, you know, they mm-hmm. kind of forget who set the pace before, mm-hmm. but it was Oxbow for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No doubt. Well, so what did, if you had 40 some brood mares, how were the colts trained? I mean, I know you had the pick of the litter, mm-hmm. so to speak. And then were there other, was Bobby still there? And
yes.
Mike Hack.
Bobby and Mike Hack uh-huh. And you know, both excellent trainers and really, really good people. So then there were plenty of horses to go around. That was the other thing. There's just, you know, there's such great horses, and there were so many of them, you uh-huh. know. And I look back at those, you know, we'd have 10 or 12 or 15 colts we were, you know, starting, and you couldn't pick one. You know, they were all that good. They were all at that level. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, personal preference or mm-hmm. who had the best cow that day or something. But Dan fully believed in, you know, marketing, and that's, you know, where his genius lies. And he would, we would take half of them and fit them for the sale, and, you know, half we would train and show, because he thought it was important to establish, if you establish a breeding program, you have to have a performance program as well, so people can come back and say, we want an Oxbow horse, mm-hmm. which is exactly what he did. And he came up, you know, Milt Bradford, there was a single sales company at that time, but the sales weren't, you know, near what they are, have been in the last 20, 25 years. So he told Milt he was going to have a dispersal sale, but it was going to be different. We were going to pair horses. And that was the first time that was ever done. But it's been done since, but they're not, they don't do it like Dan did it. What we did was we picked the two best studs and put them together. So Dan's, you know, theory was, you know, the buyer picks which stud or which pair, which horse he wants. Mm-hmm. We retain the other one and train it. It's not for sale. Mm-hmm. So only one of these pairs for sale. Mm-hmm. But we weren't picking the top five and hide them in the barn and then pair the rest of them like they've done since. We didn't do that. Dan, everything was out on the table. So we had every horse paired, and then the high bidder picked their horse and took it home, and then we trained the other one. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing Dan did, and that was, again, to give buyers confidence that there are no hidden mm-hmm. no hidden animals, no hidden fees, no hidden anything. Uh-huh. We partnered with, I know, you know, one of the most successful ones, we partnered with Gary Belenfant, and Dan would give a third of the horse to a trainer, and we retain two-thirds. And that trainer would train the horse and own a third of him for his training or her training. And the Oxbow would pay two-thirds of all the fees other than the training, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was very successful. And mm-hmm. Gary had a horse, Doc Sparely Pepe, that was, you know, really a really good horse. He had several. He had a couple others, too, from us. But I just remember that one was kind of a favorite mm-hmm. of everybody's.
Uh-huh. That's an awesome program. I didn't know you guys did that in that way.
Dan did it with, I think Todd Beemad and Kathy Dawn and Farron Hightower had Trona, Doc's Trona. Mm-hmm. And we did several mm-hmm. with people that we wanted to do business mm-hmm. with and wanted to do business with us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Lindy, who have been your mentors?
Oh, I've had so many people that have really helped me, but I think, you know, the top of the list, of course, is Buster. Mm-hmm. I just love the classy way that I saw him at a very early on. He did a symposium in Fresno at the college, This would have been in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And just so classy, and his horses were so cowy, and I loved how he was a partner on that horse. They looked like they had a great partnership working a cow rather than, you know, trying to dominate the horse or tell the horse what to do, which there were people and you know, and still are people that prefer that method. I mm-hmm. love that Buster's horses work free and looked very desirous and mm-hmm. comfortable doing their job and enjoying their job.
Mm-hmm.
So Buster would be the number one guy. And then I'd say Larry Reeder. And then I'd have to put Ed Smith up in that category. Mm-hmm. Ed and Modine Smith were very much a big part of my life and my education in riding and appreciating great horses. Mm-hmm. And they believed in me and gave me some really great horses mm-hmm. to do that on.
Mm-hmm.
And Modine and I haul around, and I was in the top 10 several years on Miss Safari, which was their mare, and, you know, others after that. But she was, you know, pretty much the first one and my favorite that I really did start doing well in the open in Texas on, which was, you know, the ultimate for a California girl was uh-huh. to get to come to Texas and be competitive in the open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the when people and non-pros and amateurs and struggle and, you know, it's cutting's not easy, right?
No.
And so what advice do you have for those, for people?
You know, the first thing that comes in my mind is that you've really got to want it. And you can't buy it. You know, you can buy the fastest race car and you can, you know, other things that are timed events or don't take a lot of ability from the rider's point. Just get on and ride and the horse does it all. But, you know, my advice is that, you know, watch a lot. And maybe because that's how I learned, I had to watch and then go to work. And be real honest with myself, you know, what's working, what isn't working, and always come back to blaming myself. I'm hardest on myself than anybody to get better and to do a better job. But I think that riding cutting horses is so much fun in one way, but it is also the most challenging thing you can do because it requires, you know, a lot of brain power. It requires a lot of strategy. It requires you to know cattle and how to cut a cow and how to work a cow and try to figure out what that cow's going to do. So then you can do your job as a rider as far as cutting the right cow to show your horse.
Mm-hmm.
Then it requires, you know, of course, agility and balance and being in tune with your horse so you can present that picture to the judge. And you got 2.5 minutes to do that. It isn't like jumping on a horse and running through, you know, running around 3 barrels. I mean, it is intense for 2.5 minutes, and there's so many variables that you're going to have to try to control that, and some are uncontrollable, as you know, that mm-hmm. you just try to control the most you can. And within reason, do the best you can with the horse that you have. So, you know, my advice when somebody starts is to get with somebody that understands that and will help you do, you know, learn from the ground up, meaning mm-hmm. how to work a cow and the position you need to be in on a cow, whether you're on foot or you're on a horse. And then, you know, learn to be able to control that cow by the position of your horse. So it's, you know, people have to really work at it, and it's not like something you can pick up in a day. It's a process. But I think the learning curve is kind of steep for a while, but once you get it, it becomes so natural, and the best riders are very natural on a horse. And the horse and that rider become, you know, they look like they're like those horses' feet are my feet. You know, mm-hmm. It's like a very pretty dance, you know, I think, between the horse and the cow, mm-hmm. and the rider, like Buster says, has the best seat in the house.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, what about when, what do you do if you feel discouraged or have runs? Have you ever felt discouraged?
Oh, yes. I've sat down in the arena, especially at home by myself, and just, you know, bawled my eyes out, just spit, you know, and get the dirt out of my mouth and everything else. I mean, I've had, you know, huge tantrums. Hopefully they're not visible to a lot of people. I'm sure a few were at first. They're not anymore. If I throw a tantrum, I make sure it's by myself. But again, like I said earlier, you have to be your honest and your most harsh critic yourself. Because mm-hmm. usually if something goes wrong and I'm just not doing well over a course of runs, then, you know, I it's my fault. It's not the horse's fault. You know, either I didn't prepare the horse right or I'm doing something wrong. So what I try to do and tell myself then is just, you know, just regress a little bit. Just go back, get a breath. Don't try to mark 75. Don't try to win the cutting. You know, don't try to beat anybody. Mm-hmm. Try to fulfill the 21 rules. You know, do my best job to show my horse and try to mark a 71. And a lot of times when I go in with that, you know, that mindset, I'll go ahead and mark a 3 or a 4 or a 5. Mm-hmm. If I go in there and say, oh gosh, I gotta, you know, Barbara's got a 75, I gotta mark a 6 to beat her. That isn't usually, I mean, that's never how I approach it. Mm-hmm. I never have. I always say, you know what? And I shouldn't say I never used to do that, because I remember a reader telling me once, you know, he says, you know, they do pay second. And I looked at him and I went like, what? What is that supposed to mean? He says, no. He says, they do pay second and third. Uh-huh. So, you know, you may not have the win and run today. I know it's hard for you to believe, but you might not get it. And that made a big difference to me, obviously, because uh-huh. that was in Wasco, California, when he was out there working at Wayne Hodges' place. So that was in the 70s. And once I remember, I got that. Not that I like being second, because, you know, what winner does. But I think that that helped me a lot, because I thought, you know what? Sometimes, you know, and I saw it written somewhere, and I know Ray Hunt's famous for saying it, but sometimes less is more. Mm-hmm. And if you try too hard in anything, I think sometimes you're more liable to make mistakes. And if you just back off a little bit and kind of let it happen, which on a cutting horse, and it is more art than science. I truly believe that. And I think that's what Buster was so really great about when he was riding a lot, is when you back off and kind of let it happen, it looks like you're doing a lot more than you are, and it less is more. And mm-hmm. you end up, you know, scoring higher or having a better run. So when I backed off a little bit and just didn't take quite as many chances and overexposed my horse, all of a sudden, even though to me, some of my best runs, and I'm sure it's happened to you too, Barb, I didn't think I was doing enough. Mm-hmm. And I'd look up the score and everybody'd be clapping, or somebody would say, hey, great job, Lenny. And I'm going, 223. And I'd go, wow. And I was surprised. I thought, well, I thought I was in a jog the whole time. And they're going, you need to go watch your video. That was beautiful. Uh-huh. And I'm going, yeah, okay. And boy, I'd go watch that video. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, that does look kind of good. And mm-hmm. I had a show, I just showed Friday and Saturday in Belton. And I knew this was a really good run I was having, but it almost was in slow motion. But very quick. You know, I mean, the cow was quick, but I headed it quick. And it was almost like I had all kinds of time to think, and there was a lot of poise in the run. The mare was very poised, and I was very poised. And she's just 4, and I've shown her in the open. But gosh, I knew it was a good run. I mean, it felt so great. And I thought, wow. And, you know, the buzzer rang, three cows right in the middle of the pen, and he marks me 76, and I win the open on my four-year-old. But I'm thinking that is like what it's akin to me is I used to surf quite a bit when I lived in California. And when you get to the top of the wave, you just start down into that curl and you just are up at the top and you're there for a second and you're going the fastest before you start down into the curl of that wave. And you can ride that for, if you can maintain that for just a few more seconds, it's just the best. It's unbelievable. Well, you're on that peak where you can, when you're either going to wreck or you're not going to wreck, but if you just hold steady and you don't wreck, it's a great feeling. And that's the same feeling I have on those really good runs,
mm-hmm.
is that I'm right there at the peak. And if I just maintain that and don't get in the way of that horse,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
let her handle it, it's going to be really good.
Mm-hmm. It's actually in sports science, it's a state of mind, body, and emotion, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's so immersed in the moment is the thing.
Exactly.
You know, you're not trying to do anything. You're just one with your job, mm-hmm. one with the horse, one with the cow.
Mm-hmm. It's such a euphoria, you know, feeling.
Yes.
Right then. And I, you know, everybody was like going, wow, they... You know, they undermarked you. They could have marked you an 8. James Davidson says, I had you at an 8. So-and-so says, Mike Mowry goes, you know, Lydia was just. And he was really into how poised she was, you know, because the way Mike shows is so pretty.
Yeah.
And his horses are so, you know, I mean, he's just great.
Yeah.
But I, so I thought about that a lot. I thought, wow, that's, you know, if you could just bottle that,
mm-hmm.
it would be amazing, you know, mm-hmm. because, and I've had some other runs like that, but that run the other, I guess it was Friday, mm-hmm. was just like a hallmark, mm-hmm. you know, it was like, okay, my mare's ready now to go next year, because mm-hmm. she just did everything, but she was thinking so pure that she was in the same state.
Yes, and she felt comfortable with you and yeah. comfortable in her job.
Yeah, it was just great. So, and people say, you know, are you going to, you know, how long are you going to keep doing this? Well, you know, I'm going to keep doing it. If I can feel that, I'm going to do it till I'm 100. That's the best feeling I've had in a long time. That was great.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Lindy, when we're doing this, we're up here in Fort Worth, and we're getting ready to go to the luncheon for the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. So what does it mean to you to be in the Cowgirl Hall?
Well, you know, I'm going to ask you the same question in a second. But I'm going to say that I think I love celebrating the Western way of life. You know, that's mm-hmm. one thing that I love doing. I love, I hope and try to be a great ambassador for the Western way of life, and especially, you know, cutting horses. And to be honored that way in the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame, you know, means that hopefully I've set a good example for other ladies and women, young girls that you know, want to do something like this, and they, you know, they don't think they can or they'd like to. And I, you know, I want to be that person that says, you know what, if you want to, just like my dad said years ago, if you want it bad enough and want to work hard, you can achieve anything. And no matter your gender or your age or whatever. And I think that being in the Cowgirl Hall of Fame when you talk to all the other inductees, like we had the pleasure of doing last night, it's so remarkable that people all, that these ladies and women that are in this industry and have been honored like this have that one, well, more than one trait, you know, that they share. And that to me is that state of mind, that cowgirl attitude that is like, it's not being cocky, it's just being independent and not really having to lean on somebody else to do things, you know, have your, you know, if that's your path, follow your path. Stay the mm-hmm. course, you know. Mm-hmm. Enjoy the journey, but stay the course, because mm-hmm. you know you can do it if you are willing to sacrifice. And that's mm-hmm. what all these people have in their stories. You can see those common denominators that they all have risen, and now we're all kind of getting to an age where we can really enjoy it, and hopefully we can inspire mm-hmm. young people to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you?
Well, it's hard. Sometimes I just get real emotional about it. You mm-hmm. know, just even walking into that building, I feel that way, because I feel so honored, and a little bit like Shorty last night, like, are you guys sure you didn't get this wrong? You know, not in a self-degrading way, but in a amazing way and grateful way. And I just am so, I love studying human potential, because I think we all have this great spirit in us, and life isn't easy. And the women who are in the Hall of Fame through the Western way of life, through horses and cattle and art, and you know, there are many categories, mm-hmm. Service to others, they just have a vision, and they just don't give up, and they are very unique, and they completely embrace their uniqueness and express it in such mm-hmm. beautiful ways and contribute to the lives of others. And to number one, just to go to that building. So if anyone has never been to that and they ever come to Fort Worth, it's a very inspiring place to be, because it's beautifully done. But to be at this event, and to, like you said, to be around the women, and then to go to the luncheon today, just, you know, it's like my yearly dose of inspirational heroin or something. It's like, shoot me up with this amazing stories and women, and I'm just honored and grateful and have a big smile on my face, and I just am so grateful.
You know, that that's really well said. The thing that people have asked me before is, do you have to ride horses to be in the Cowgirl Hall of Fame? And I tell them, no. What it really is, it's a state of mind. And I know a lot mm-hmm. of cowgirls that are in politics, and a lot of cowgirls that are in business. And when I say that, it's more of they're independent, but they've got that I can get this done attitude. No matter if it's a project, it's an invention, it's whatever their career course is. And it's like, you know, you don't give up. You just stay with them and stay with your thoughts, and, you know, always improve. You know, every day, I hope I learn something, and I do learn something better, mm-hmm. Better to do on a horse, better to do, and when I'm teaching people, better to, you know, whatever I can do to improve. Mm-hmm. I don't really like people that stay stagnant or not try to, you know, keep reaching. And I think all that attitude is kind of a reaching attitude, and one that you're comfortable in your own body. Mm-hmm. And I love hearing these women's stories, and they're very comfortable now. They're very comfortable, especially in our setting, you know, yesterday mm-hmm. and today. Mm-hmm. You're certainly humbled to be in this group of amazing women, but you're also inspired. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm inspired.
Absolutely.
By
that's
them.
What
and,
I mean.
And you hear their stories today. We're going to, you know, of the new inductees. And I hate sitting there, because it's really not good to see Lindy Burch cry. And I start crying the whole time. And I got my mascara running down my face. And, you know, I'm short of breath. But I think, you know, this is my time. I cry every luncheon for every year. You know, and I do cry during some commercials, too, I have to admit. But the good ones, especially about the little dogs or the Clydesdales. God, I hate that. I cry. but it's a good cry, and it's uh-huh. good it's good to be around people like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it, like you said, it's like an injection once a year.
Yeah,
good one.
Yes. Well, Lindy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Really, it's a pleasure. Really.
We've known each other a long time, and you have been so great for our industry in so many ways, and people have learned so much from you and continue to learn from you. It's my honor and pleasure to call you my friend.
Yes, thank you. Same here. Thank you for coming, and thank you for being the awesome cowgirl you are.
Thank you.
This year, Lindy is going to haul for the Open and 25 Novice World titles in cutting aboard Skeet Nadell and her 2 4-year-olds, Raisin Betts and Stylish Talkin. I know you'll join me in rooting her on. You go, Lindy. Thank you for listening. And until next time, have fun, enjoy your horse, and be kind to yourself. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to The Barbara Schulte Show. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram to stay tuned for future episodes.